Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, today we are going to finish our panel discussion of Peter Hessler's book, Country Driving, A Chinese Road Trip. That sounds like a lot to get out sometimes. But remember, this is the last book that we will be discussing in our Around the World in Book series. Now, our next series, Summer of Classics, will begin on June 26th, and I will be introducing Jane Austen's novel Pride and Prejudice. Well, the 60-plus panel is back with me in the studio today, so welcome, Daryl.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you.
I thought what we'd do today is for today's program, we'll just jump right into Book 3, The Factory. And all of you out there listening, now, we've really skipped through Books 1 and Books 2 very quickly. But again, we can only give you snippets of these books, and that really puts the pressure on you to actually read the book. And I think it's a terrific book. I think it's probably one of the most informative books I've read, certainly, on China. And I think it's just a master, or Hessler is such a master at combining Chinese history with what's happening today. It's really a very well done book. So how I'd like to begin today is just tell you that when I started reading Book 3, I have to be honest that I really found it a little difficult to get into the book. And I think probably some of you out there are having the same kind of trouble. But once I got into Book 3, I think, to be honest, it's really maybe one of the better books and of the three, even though, I still love Book 1. And by the way, I still love Book 2. But anyway, I think it's fascinating with the way he opens up the book. And he makes some just incredible statements that I think are just really close to poetry. And it's one of those things that I think is just, when I see a writer that can do this, I'm just always amazed. Now, remember, in this book three, now Peter is not driving north. In fact, he's driving south. And I have a little nickname for the south now. I call it the land of scam. And I'll tell you why here in a minute. I think, again, he does connect the whole book together with this idea of driving and driving in China. And now he has me totally convinced I do not want to ever drive in China. I don't even want to walk in sidewalks on sidewalks in China. But I think there's just the funniest thing. He opens up the book three, and this is page 281. And he's comparing when he rented from Beijing's Capital Motors with now he had to find a new company, and I guess it's Wenzhou, and that's in the south. So I'll just break out. It's right in the first paragraph. He says, in the city of Wenzhou, they rented out cars with an empty tank. The first time I went there and picked up a Volkswagen Santana in July of 2005, that was my welcome. And so he's going to compare now what happens in Wenzhou with what happened with Capital Motors in Beijing. He says, I paid my deposit, put the key in the ignition, and the low fuel warning light flashed on. There was barely enough in the tank to make it to a gas station. Now, for any American out there listening, you know that none of us would ever tolerate, renting a car and turning the car on and there'd be no fuel in it. That's just, we would just stop dead and say, give me a new car. He said there was barely enough in the tank to make it to a gas station. In the past, when I'd rented from Beijing's Capital Motors, I complained about inconsistent fuel levels, but the folks at the Wenzhou Prosperous Automobile Rental Company, now that name is significant there because that really, the word prosperous really does describe what China wants us to look at the South as, a very prosperous area of the country. But they had solved that problem in their own entrepreneurial way. If I returned this antenna with so much as a gallon left in the tank, it would be siphoned out and sold. And so that's why I call the South, the land of scam, because that seems like that's what they're best at. He goes on to say, before that, I had never rented a car in the South, and I hadn't spent much time driving in Chinese cities. Almost all of my journeys had been in the countryside of the North, where I became accustomed to a rural rhythm, the busy mornings of spring planting, the road threshings of autumn. In winter, I spent quiet days in villages where most young people were already gone. And so that is really, kind of humorous. If you go to page 356 then, he talks about more about the South, and I don't want to spend a lot of time with this because we have a lot of things we want to discuss today. But he on page 356, he talks about speeding tickets. Now, in the North, if you remember, what he was doing there was highly illegal. He wasn't allowed to be driving out of Beijing, by the way. And then certainly as a journalist, he wasn't to be driving alone. But now he's in the South. He is driving alone. And the thing that he came up against, which really kind of bothered him, is he was assessed many, many, many speeding tickets. So you can see just the time he spent there. he lived there 11 years. And so when he got into the South in the boomtown areas, he learned that the Chinese learned very quickly how to scam everybody. Says, in a Chinese boomtown, though, it's all business, factories, and construction supplies and cell phone shops. The free market shapes all early stages of growth, which is why the entertainment options appear instantly, but social organizations are rare. No private newspapers, no independent labor unions. Such things are banned by the Communist Party. Religion might flourish at the individual level, but institutions are weak. In Li Xu's development zone, nobody built a church or a temple. There weren't any law firms or nonprofit organizations. Police and government cadres were almost as rare. They showed up only when there was some opportunity for profiteering. It says, on the Jinlwen Expressway, my first encounter with authority occurred in July of 2006 when I received a speeding ticket. It was fully automated. I didn't learn about the fine until I returned the Santana to the prosperous automobile rental company. Their computer showed that I had been photographed while driving 96 kilometers per hour in an 80-kilometer zone. The fine, of a total of about $25, was deducted directly from my deposit. And so he ran. All of a sudden, he ran against modernity. He says, after that first violation, the floodgates opened wide, and I collected tickets in factory towns all along the expressway. One camera caught me outside of Kuiatao, the button town, and then I got fined in Jinshua, famous for producing underwear. The most tickets I received in a single day was 3. One in Luxi, I got nailed twice in less than an hour. I was not a reckless driver, and my prior record had been spotless. In 5 years with a Chinese license, I never had a violation until I went to Xinjiang. And so it's amazing what he encountered with driving, now in the South. It's a whole different world, and I think that's what this book brings across so well, is that the people in the North are so different than the people in the South. And he does make, I won't even turn there, but he does make quite a poetic statement on page 283, and I hope you'll take the time to read it, is when he went South, he said he was not off to find the relics of the past, but to find the new cities where all the young people fled from the North. So I think that's really quite poetic. And, of course, we have, Derry Hope in here, and Derry has spent actually time in the South. And so I'm going to turn this over to you now and let you talk a little bit about what it's like to be in the entrepreneurial spirit in China.
Well, it's interesting that Peter Hesser talks about the difference between the North and the South of China, because there are differences across China. When we think of China, we usually think of a monolithic power and that everyone is alike. And I think we get that impression from the fact that the Han Chinese, which make up the ethnic population of China, are about 92% of the population. So we have this idea that everything's very homogeneous. Chinese society is alike all over the place. But it's really very different. There are lots of linguistic differences. There are seven noted dialects that are considered as the main dialects that are different. There are another 200 dialects that are different as well, but the seven main ones are the ones that are key. So you notice that in going through this in the South, when you get into the South, that you're hearing different dialects from the North. And so people are speaking a language that they can talk among themselves, and someone who speaks Mandarin wouldn't understand them.
Right, and that's how they take advantage of each other.
Absolutely. That's one of the ways in which you can help take advantage of one another.
It's the way to do the scam.
Right.
Just speak in your dialect.
Absolutely. Yeah. But there is this entrepreneurial spirit in the South. So Chinese do view the people from the South as being very entrepreneurial and very business-oriented. And I really think that over history, over time, has come from the connection with Hong Kong, because the Chinese in Hong Kong are considered the most entrepreneurial Chinese. And those Chinese that are in the areas near Hong Kong, Guangzhou, the whole province of Guangdong, have the same kind of spirit, and that is that they are very very frugal, as you see here about the way they rent the car, and you don't leave a gallon of gas in the car or they'll siphon it off. They're very frugal in the way that they handle things, and they're also very innovative. In fact, the city of Guangzhou, which is the city where this car was rented and where he started off, that city is really considered to be the capital of the entrepreneurs. And so all across China, they view people from Guangzhou as being people that are very savvy in setting up businesses. And there even are books in China, in Chinese, about the Wenzhou spirit and being like someone from Wenzhou, being able to really set up a business and have it become very successful very quickly. So that sort of persona is very common in the South of China, that they view things this way.
But one of the things that really was really shocking to me, though, is that, you know, I think Americans kind of pride themselves in their honesty in business, or they have pride in, you know, not hurting the other guy.
Right.
But it doesn't seem that way in China. It doesn't seem like they're afraid to, well, just take each other if they have to.
Well, I think the Chinese, as you see throughout this book, are very pragmatic and very practical. And when it comes to earning profit, if you have to be sometimes on the wrong side of the truth in order to earn a profit, then
it's a nice way of saying that they lie.
that's considered certainly doable. And there's one place in the book that Hessler, I think, sums it all up. It's on page 357. Where he talking about the boomtown society, and he says, like so many aspects of boomtown life, which is basically the South of China because it's that way, it wasn't exactly lawless. In fact, there were strict rules that governed police investment, but these were the rules of hierarchy and profit, not law and order. So those are really the ways of hierarchy and profit, not law and order. So there are lots of rules and lots of little things that people follow. That give the semblance of being very orderly and lawful, but in actuality, it's profit and hierarchy that really count.
But he does bring out in that same section, we can just point this out. This is on page 355 for all those who are listening, and I'm not going to read all the quotes. I'll let you read them. I'll start demanding that you read so we're not reading to you. But you know, if you look as here, China's going south to develop. Americans went west, and I think Peter does a great job of bringing out the history of America and saying when Americans moved west, some of the first buildings they built were like a courthouse, and they would build a jail, and then they would build government buildings, you know, and they would build a church. But in China, when they went south, they built factories.
Right. And sometimes factories before roads.
Right.
Right. Factories before roads. Right. And I think that's another surprising thing is, you know, you would get the impression that the Chinese would do things in order, but they don't necessarily do it in order. They built the factory first.
Right. Right.
And then the roads later. But then I think maybe you can remember where this other part of the book is, where there's another province, I guess, or another city in the South, where they actually built the roads first, and not the
Right. Well, this is Zhejiang. In Zhejiang, that's where they build the roads first. It's in Guangdong, which is the one closer to Hong Kong, where they're more practical in terms of being more businesslike because they've seen the experience of Hong Kong. So they build the roads first there and then the factories. But the Chinese way is really, because you're so pragmatic, is to approach the thing that's going to earn you the most income first. What's that? That's the factory. Build the factory first, and then everything else follows after that.
Right. Well, one thing I thought, we can bring this out. Let's talk about the people, you know, that are in the South. And Hessler does bring out in his book, and again, you can find this on page 283, where he talks about some of the statistics of the city, or maybe it's actually 283 is where he talks about the relics of the past. But it's actually page 364 where he talks about China's population, and these are old statistics, and they have to be. And I think they're going towards, when he wrote this, there was 1.3 billion citizens there. I think they're heading towards 1.8, by 2018. That's a lot of people. But he says 72% of the people are between the ages of 16 to 64. And so there is this big labor force in China that's absolutely amazing. But what's amazing to me, though, is when you get into these cities, all these young people have gone to the cities, you know, and there's actually teens, and I know my wife wants to talk about the teenagers there, but there's actually teens that they're cheating to get to work. I mean, they lie about their age so they can get to work. And so they start very young at 16. And what's really shocking is they get into these factories, and some of them are very dangerous with chemicals and all that. And they'll work and they're making 40 cents an hour, you know. And so, to me, we have Boss Gao, we have Boss Wang, we have some pretty good details about them. But they care about the business, but it doesn't seem like they really care about the people or what's really happening, you know, to their workers. Right. So,
well, I think when you've got, you know, 1+ billion people, that's a disposable commodity. And that really is the way it is in China. You know, it's the people, it's like, well, if this person won't do the job, that's okay, because the next person will.
Right.
And so that tends to drive wages down. And so you just have this great wealth of humanity in China, and so that's a disposable commodity, and they don't take the same pains with people that we might find in a Western culture.
That's right. For any American out there that's really upset with America, in China there is no human resources department at the factories. So, so if you don't like your job, they say, tough beans, there's another person to take your place. So Deborah, you want to talk about the Tao family?
Yeah, so that was funny because that's how it introduces in this family where he says that there's no human resources department. If you get the job or you don't. But we're introduced to this girl who ends up being Tao Yufeng, but she actually says that she's her sister, and she's very persistent, and the boss actually is Mr. Peter Hessler just describes this interaction, and to me it would seem like it'd be very annoying, but she just is persistent, and he keeps saying, no, I don't want any more, I've had my quota, no more, but she keeps persisting, and he eventually gives in, and it turns out she was only 15.
She couldn't work anyway legally.
No, legally she couldn't. And he shook his head in admiration and said, that girl knows how to get things done. And so, but it says, in time the bosses would learn that the young woman wasn't at all who she claimed to be. She had no experience. She had never worked in a factory. She hadn't been anywhere near Guangdong province. She wasn't 17, and she wasn't Tao Yuren. That was her older sister's name. She had borrowed the ID card and bluffed about everything. The girl who got things done was barely 15 years old. So she ends up being, you know, a strong force, really good worker. But then by them accepting her, then She ends up bringing in her older sister because, well, you know, they already had her, the ID. So, of course, you know, so, and then she ends up getting her father in, too. So, but it seems like the bosses, they accept that's the way things are done. It's like what Derry Hope was saying, that we don't really think that way, but they accept the fact that people are going to lie, and they accept the fact that that's what's going to happen, and that's just the way it is. It's practical, and you work with it that way. So it's kind of interesting.
So essentially, let me just interrupt you. So essentially, what they do is they hire people based on their initiative,
mm-hmm. right?
How they present themselves and how forceful they are, mm-hmm. not so much on their talent. And listen to that, all you young teenage Americans. Yes. If you lived in China, they wouldn't care if you were talented. You
know? That's right. It's right. It's an issue. And that's what's interesting is they have a really different way of looking at life. And that's why I wanted to read on page 385, I think, where he makes a comment about teenagers there. And he's talking about these girls had gotten together for a birthday party. And, you know, there's this one 15-year-old, there's a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old. And they're having a good time. Right up until this point, the 15-year-old had encouraged the older boss, a man, to get drunk. They weren't drinking, but they encouraged him to get drunk.
Yeah, so they could do what they wanted.
So he wouldn't, you know, push him around. So, but anyway, they're laughing. And then at one point he says that this one girl, she got some stuffed animals for her gifts. And like all the girls, she sometimes seemed younger than her years. They never mention boys, at least not in mixed company, and they obey their parents with a readiness that would have been unimaginable to an American teenager. But in other ways, they were remarkably mature. So they had the qualities that where they seemed innocent, but yet they were very mature, and a lot of it was the way they worked. They had a really strong work ethic, and you know, they were what they thought about the future. That's what they thought about in jobs and the future. And, you know, just like all the young people were moving to where the jobs were.
Let me just say this. It is interesting that Yu Fang, though she didn't have any experience, she hardly worked ever before outside, you know, of their home. And yet when she came into the bra factory, she could make more underwires than anybody else prior to her.
Yes.
You know, that's how she was so focused and so concentrated. And I think that is the proper idea, a way to look at a Chinese person.
I think I'm always amazed by the work ethic of Chinese youth. And I've seen it with students, you know, in settings. They are amazing. They will do whatever needs to be done to make a situation or themselves successful, no matter how long it takes. And it's really amazing to see that. That would be, I know that American students that would watch them would be amazed also, and they would realize they need to beef it up some.
Maybe we should start sending American students there.
I think
there.
We should. That would be a good thing.
But don't send them to college. Send them to the factory
right,
areas.
In the factory. Right, yes. They would learn very fast.
Yes. Okay, Deborah, I'm sorry.
Well, that's basically it. There's that dichotomy that they seem innocent and seem young, but yet they have such a mature attitude toward work that they'll be willing to do anything. And then it says at the end there that they were, that, but some teenager qualities are the same everywhere. And once the ennui girls started talking, their faces lit up and they couldn't have been happier. For an hour, Ren Jing sat with her friends, chatting about old jobs and new bosses and which factories are the best. So they were talking about jobs. So that's what their life, you know, that's their life. You know?
I don't think,
and that's what made them enjoyed their lives.
Sorry, but I don't think a group of teenagers in America would be sitting around talking about their bosses and their jobs.
No.
I think they'd be talking about the latest music hit.
Probably.
Or the latest, you know, video. Or,
right.
But I do think one of the, you know, I think a lot of the listening audiences knows that I'm really interested in art. And I think that this whole thing, I think it fits in the ancient Weir art village. So not only do they want to take advantage of, you know, the factories, and they're making buttons, and they're making, you know, straws, and they're making plastic toys and all that. They wanted to get in on the art market. And I think it's the funniest scene, and it's page 401, and it's just, I know we're getting close to time here, but I think this conversation, Peter Hessler goes into this art community, And what they want to do is they want to kind of have a green environment. They want to have a green industry. And this is as they're progressing through, this boom. And they realize that they are probably damaging the environment with the, there's a lot of funny things in here about pleather weather when they were making the fake leather and all these dangerous chemicals, and they're polluting the air and the water and the soil and all that. But Hessler goes to find this art community. They want to develop a green industry. And he sees these artists, and they're in there. They're making duplicates or replications of, like, the Dutch masters and all that. And he goes to this one artist, and he said, I asked her how she first became interested in art. She says, because I was a terrible student, Mizey said. I had bad grades, and I couldn't get into high school. It's easier to get accepted to an art school than a technical school, so that's what I did. Did you like to draw when you were little? No, she said. But you had natural talent, right? She says, absolutely none at all, she said. When I started, I couldn't even hold a brush. He says, did you study well? No, I was the worst in the class, she said. He said, but did you enjoy it? No, I didn't like it one bit. And so I think that's what we're saying is, and of course, Derry brought us out, and Deborah, you brought it out, that the funny thing is they'll do whatever it takes to make money. And, I think it also shows, anybody that's a budding artist out there, you can learn to draw whether you like it or not. So there are many, many things in this book that we don't have time to talk about. There's the whole Tao family, which is very interesting. We have Master Luo. That's L-U-O. He is just a great guy. And what he goes through and what his family goes through, there's a lot of discussion about what happens in these boom communities, and I would never eat in a restaurant in one of the boom communities. No. I mean, I guess people will eat in China, they'll eat just about anything, rats and snakes and mules and donkeys and dogs, and so we don't even want to go there. Well, it looks like we are running out of time, so remember, next time we're going to introduce our Summer of Classics series, and we're really looking forward to the books. We're going to do Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. We're going to do Dickens' Great Expectations. We're going to do the science fiction classic 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And then we have the mystery book, which we haven't revealed yet. So, I would very much like to hear what you have to say about country driving. Please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. The address is facebook.com/justthebestliterature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.